today on Wings.
Then that little man in black there, he says women can't have as much rights as men because Christ wasn't a woman. Where did your Christ come from? Where did your Christ come from? From God and a woman. Man had nothing to do with him.
There's a river of birds in migration, a nation of women with wings.
Welcome to Wings, a series of news and current affairs programs by and about women around the world, produced and distributed by the Women's International News Gathering Service.
Elena McMaster is a producer for the long-running radio series Women on the Line, produced at 3CR Community Radio in Melbourne, Australia. Today, she shares with Wings a program about the economic value of women as producers and reproducers, and also women who have stood up against exploitation of that value.
Stay with us for the next half hour. We're going to take you on a journey into the murky world of political theory, to the place where feminism bumps up against Karl Marx.
Gender identity basically has no meaning outside of this reproductive, productive division of labor. If there wasn't a reproductive, productive division of labor, what does it mean to be a man? What does it mean to be a woman? These are like kind of like lumped together traits that then are read as like masculine or feminine, but they have a historical genesis and they have a historical, you know, evolution.
Don't worry, we will be explaining some of that Marxist jargon along the way. Marx gave us some words that help us understand and possibly transform society, but they're also pretty indecipherable if you're not familiar with his work. To start with,
reproductive labour is the work involved in what Marx and Engels called the reproduction of labour power, that is, the bearing and raising of children and the maintenance of a household. Without this labour, the socio-economic system would simply collapse.
And?
Historical materialism is a framework for understanding history where we look at the material conditions of people's lives and how these conditions are reproduced over time and how they affect the way people think and act in society.
And?
Productive labour basically means paid work. Marx, Engels, and Marxist theorists regard this as the site of revolutionary consciousness as wage labourers realise and rebel against the exploitation of their labour for profit.
Holly and Nikki will be providing a bit of a glossary of terms throughout the program. So we'll be hearing from several Marxist feminists about gender, race, and capitalism. Anastasia Gomez, Laura Renata Martin, Maya Gonzalez, and Silvia Federici were recorded in 2011 at a historical materialism conference in New York. We'll also be hearing some words of struggle, love, and freedom, words from the past and present which might illuminate the struggle for a just world and encourage us to have some romance along the way. First, some words from history. Here's Alice Walker reading an 1851 speech by the famous feminist and abolitionist Sojourner Truth.
Well, children, where there's so much racket, there must be something out of kilter. I think that twixt the Negroes of the South and the women at the North, all talking about rights, the white men will be in a fix pretty soon. But what's all this here talking about? That man over there says that women need to be helped into carriages and lifted over ditches and have the best place everywhere. Nobody ever helps me into carriages or over mud puddles or gives me any best place. And ain't I a woman? Look at me. Look at my arm. I have plowed and planted and gathered into barns, and no man could head me. And ain't I a woman? I could work as much and eat as much as a man when I could get it, and bear the lash as well. And ain't I a woman? I have borne 13 children and seen most all sold off to slavery. And when I cried out with my mother's grief, none but Jesus heard me. And ain't I a woman? Then they talk about this thing in the head. What's this they call it? Intellect. That's right, honey. Intellect. What's that got to do with women's rights or Negroes' rights? If my cup won't hold but a pint and yours holds a quart, wouldn't you be mean not to let me have my little half measure full? Then that little man in black there, he says women can't have as much rights as men because Christ wasn't a woman. Where did your Christ come from? Where did your Christ come from? From God and a woman. Man had nothing to do with him. If the first woman God ever made was strong enough to turn the world upside down all alone, these women together ought to be able to turn it back and get it right side up again. And now that they is asking to do it, the men better let them.
What is the difference between saying housework produces labor power instead of saying housework is an act of love, right? Immediately, I think we also need to say what is the politics of it. What does it mean? What difference does it make in terms of our political action, and particularly in terms of an anti-capitalist strategy?
Considering the feminization of labor that's occurred over the past couple of decades, we all know that within the industrialized countries, there's been a massive entry of women into the paid workforce. And, you know, now women pretty much work in the paid workforce on equal levels as men in the industrialized world. And a lot of the bourgeois press has been reporting that the wage gap is diminishing. There's a lot of prominent examples of famous women in high positions of power, like Sarah Palin or Condoleezza Rice or Oprah. And people are like, does capitalism still need gender? Does it still need this, you know, gender division of reproductive and productive labor? So that's the question. So we tried to look over a lot of the Marxist feminist debates that have tried to really like locate the material basis of women's oppression in capitalist society and the way that it gets materially reproduced. And most Marxist feminists look at the creation between the productive and the reproductive spheres within capitalism, you know, in order to answer this question and look at that as kind of like what gives coherence to gender identity.
Division of labor means organizing ourselves collectively so that different people do different tasks. Under capitalism, the division of labor has become increasingly complex. You may be familiar with Henry T. Ford's idea of the factory production line, which changed manufacturing irrevocably into a series of small tasks, often menial, performed by different workers along the line. New divisions have also arisen between manual or menial labour and intellectual work. There's also, of course, the giant elephant in the room, the one that classical Marxists and economists in general have been reluctant to address. The gendered division of labour, which divides the private domestic labour done mostly by women from the public social labour done by men and increasingly women.
The way that we kind of understand this to work, the racial division of labour being relying on the reproductive, productive division of labour, is that from the beginning, and this we take from a lot from Federici, from Mises, from the Alla Costa, is that, you know, from the beginning, there's been a split with first and third world. The process of colonization made the nuclear family possible. There was a long process of colonization that made wage labor be able to arise within the industrialized centers of the world. And as a result, these two divisions have always been interdependent. They've always existed like in a relationship with each other where they've been enabled by each other. So when we say the racial division of labor, we mean the fact that, you know, capitalism needs a racial division of labor. It needs competition between workers, and that competition is also between capitalists to find the cheapest worker, right? So capital travels all over the world trying to find the cheapest worker possible. And the way that it usually achieves this is by bringing in previously excluded people into this social body of labor. And for that reason, they're usually marked as culturally different, racially different, ethnic, nationally different, whatever the historical basis of their low wages is, what kind of marks them as different within the social body of labor. We draw from the work of Selma James when she's talking about how racism and sexism are functions of the division of labor, in the sense that people enter the division of labor and then their position within the division of labor trains them in a specialized way that then are read as like natural characteristics of that group of people who are within that location. So, you know, changing diapers is a job for women. And racism is very much a part of constantly reproducing this competition between workers, rationalizing the inequalities within the class. There's no monolithic experience of women. There's no universal experience of women. It's differed very dramatically by race, by class, where, you know, working class women have had a very different experience of being women than middle class women, than women of color. Yeah.
The redistribution, the globalization of care, right? The redistribution of domestic work, care work, the production of labor power, right? On the shoulder of immigrant women, that certainly is creating a major crisis on so many levels, because at the end of a chain, you have children who are not being cared for, and also the power relation between women and so forth. The marketization of housework reproduction through services, it's also a terrain of crisis. We now see what does it mean, for example, to lose control over your food production, to lose control over nutrition.
Across Australia, you're listening to Women on the Line on the Community Radio Network. Today, we're bringing you some feminist Marxist theory from the Historical Materialism Conference in New York in 2011. Theorists and activists Anastasia Gomez, Maya Gonzalez, Silvia Federici, and Laura Renata Martin speak on gender and race in capitalism. And some current and historical voices on struggle and love. This is Kate Tempest, a poet and performer from England, with What We Came After.
I tell of him who summoned them storms in vengeance, poisoned by the wrath of his remembrance, him that gave language just to impose a sentence. His name was Prospero, and he prospers by what he knows. Knowledge he keeps for himself, and it is used for the bad, to enslave and to mystify. No, the language that fills up your mouth is imposition, and subject your ambition to a bootless inquisition. Look, Prospero, wronged, survived. He grew wise. He got fattened on them books. He despised when he should have dismissed. Well, that to this is all relative. Madness for those who can't measure it. Sadness for those who seek sedative, but gladness for those who know pleasure is all self-constructed, who know how to clutch it. Look, if by your art you would fever the skies, you need to let the heat within rise and evaporate. If you're the type to seize the sea's tides, it's against you, you will never navigate. I know the language is for those obsessed with real meaning. Don't love the oppressor or trust the oppressor, but don't begrudge the oppressor the oppressor's oppression, because each has to learn their own lessons. Look, if all these people were prophets, we'd profit. We were born with the truth, but then we lost it in logic, so go and find it. Remind yourself of the timeless, because you are the planet that bred you, and you are the language that led you, and you are the knowledge that fed you. So just own it. Make it make sense and make it relevant, and never believe that the words of the wise are not your words to read. See, when I hear the quiet voice of vengeance in my ear, that's when I know that hell is empty, because all the devils are here. When my tongue tastes shadows and all my friends are shedding tears, that's when I know that hell is empty, because all the devils are here. When my heart is consumed with regret and with fear, that's when I know that hell is empty, because all the devils are here. And when the boat sails away and I get left on the pier, that's when I know that hell is empty, because all the devils are here. When you're trying to understand but the text isn't clear, when a demon jumps up straight rejecting the spear, when the view is so bleak it starts infecting the seer, that's when you know that hell is empty, because all the devils are here. So call me Caliban. They gave me language so I could rain down these curses in verses, and I will take them on word for word. Because believe me, the worst is that I have to watch my good friends getting caught up in circuits. You see, the serpent, he rehearses his hisses. He makes the valiant vicious, and I know now never to waste wishes. So go on then, conjure a storm on the head of your enemy. You're going to find yourself victim of negative energy. What you need to do is extend your empathy. Make yourself sensitive. This island was mine for a home. I was free to make rhyme as I roamed. Now my mind is alone as I writhe and I moan. I'm the captive of consonants, and I beseech you to be much more confident. Because we run around nonchalant, dejected and restless, like, oh, we can't change nothing though, so why should we try? But look, we can change. We can rampage till we stand strange. Right now we got our hands chained, clutching at freedom. You know, the freedom of mean what you say and say it with meaning. We need to change our own minds before we try and change the sequence. We need to live with our energy, not by our reason. Look, this the last day of my discontented season. No more will I tolerate this greed, it's demeaning. We're needing a breeze through the stifling heat of elitist descriptions of what we can reach. Look, they want you to fear it, to not get too near it, so they can continue pretending they're smarter. Sit still, though. Receive it from self like Siddhartha. The past is just what we came after. So when you hear the quiet voice of vengeance in your ear, that's when you know that hell is empty, because all the devils are here. When your heart is consumed with regret and with fear, that's when you know that hell is empty, because all the devils are here. When your tongue can taste shadows and your friends are shedding tears, that's when you know that hell is empty, because all the devils are here. And when the boat sails away and you get left on the pier, that's when you know that hell is empty, because all the devils are here. When you're trying to understand but the text isn't clear, when a demon jumps up straight rejecting your spear, when the view is so bleak it starts infecting the seer, that's when you know that hell is empty, because all the devils are here.
The basic problem with capitalism is that having a reserve army or a surplus population, also having lots of poor people means that they tend to become unruly, right? So we have class struggle.
Capitalism is a social and economic system where one group of people own the means of production, for example, a factory or a farm, and buy the labour power of another group of people to work for them and increase the value of their property. The people who own the means of production are called the bourgeoisie. The people who don't own the means of production and sell their labour power are called the proletariat. The way the system works is that the proletariat work more than is necessary to provide for their own needs, thus providing the bourgeoisie with surplus value, what we commonly call profit.
And times of class struggle tend to be linked to increased impulses to control women's sexuality and fertility, because women are literally the people who are the bearers of future generations of groups of people. They therefore represent the life force that has to be kind of managed or controlled. Some obvious examples are the experiments with eugenics in the early 20th century, which in many ways were a response to all the waves of European immigration and the labor unrest that flowed from that. And eugenics specifically targeted women's fertility, arguing for sterilization of women, of poor women, women of color, in order to recompose the racial composition of the nation, at the same time encouraging women, upper-class white women, to forbidding them from having access to birth control and encouraging them to, not commit race suicide.
At the time, the Lowell cotton mills were started, the factory girl was the lowest among women. In England, and in France particularly, great injustice had been done to her real character. She was represented as subjected to influences that could not fail to destroy her purity and self-respect. In the eyes of her overseer, she was but a brute, a slave, to be beaten, pinched, and pushed about. One of the first strikes of the cotton factory operatives that ever took place in this country was that in Lowell in October 1836. When it was announced that wages were to be cut down, great indignation was felt, and it was decided to strike en masse. This was done. The mills were shut down, and the girls went in procession from their several corporations to the Grove on Chapel Hill and listened to incendiary speeches from early labor reformers. One of the girls stood on a pump and gave vent to the feelings of her companions in a neat speech, declaring that it was their duty to resist all attempts at cutting down the wages. This was the first time a woman had spoken in public in Lowell, and the event caused surprise and consternation among her audience. Cutting down the wages was not their only grievance, nor the only cause of this strike. Hitherto, the corporations had paid 25 cents a week towards the board of each operative, and now it was their purpose to have the girls pay the sum. And this, in addition to the cut in wages, would make a difference of at least $1 a week. It was estimated that as many as 12 or 1,500 girls turned out and walked in procession through the streets. My own recollection of this first strike, or turnout, as it was called, is very vivid. I worked in a lower room where I had heard the proposed strike fully, if not vehemently, discussed. I had been an ardent listener to what was said against this attempted oppression on the part of the corporation, and naturally I took sides with the strikers. When the day came on which the girls were to turn out, those in the upper room started first, and so many of them left that our mill was at once shut down. Then, when the girls in my room stood irresolute, uncertain what to do, asking each other, "Would you or shall we turn out?" and not one of them having the courage to lead off, I, who began to think they would not go out after all their talk, became impatient and started on ahead, saying with childish bravado, "I don't care what you do. I am going to turn out whether anyone else does or not." And I marched out and was followed by the others. As I looked back at the long line that followed me, I was more proud than I have ever been at any success I may have ever achieved.
Harriet Hanson Robinson was a bobbin duffer in a Massachusetts cotton mill. She started working in the mill when she was only 10 years old. At the age of 11, she was involved in her first strike when the girls and women at Lowell Cotton Mill walked off the job. She later became a leading activist in the women's suffrage movement. Her published recollection of the strike, or turnout as they called it, was read by Lily Taylor.
Controlling women's sexuality is a mechanism of social control that is very useful for containing and diffusing class struggle, especially in response to racial anxiety, which is produced by the racial division of labor, which is always kind of an ongoing process of migration and new workers entering into the division of labor. We say that there's an inherent tension in the capitalist mode of production between, on the one hand, the need for cheap, racialized workers in large numbers to keep labor costs down, and on the other hand, the need to maintain social order and to minimize state subsidies for the poor.
To me, one of the fundamental issues today, through these forms of reconstitution, of reproduction, is also the need to confront the devaluation of reproductive work in capitalism. I think that that's a fundamental objective and ground for every struggle. Because whatever form of reproduction we construct prior to that and together with that reconstruction has to be the work of revalorizing, and not revalorizing in a capitalist sense, but revalorizing in the sense of use value, in the sense of revalorization of our life. Right, the question of the reproduction of our life. And that is premised on the recognition that one of the fundamental flaws of capitalism is that it structurally, systematically based on the devaluation of life, on the devaluation of reproduction.
You confide in me that you are lonely, that romance, juicy and red, never stays long at your house. But when I visit you, what do I find? You do not own a sofa. Without a sofa, preferably burgundy or maroon, you cannot expect to have romance come and stay in your house. A sofa is essential to all that lures romance to the boudoir. I cannot believe you are so old and do not know this. Well, lucky for you, I am older. Trying to have romance, sit down, visit, and decide to stay with you when you have no sofa on which to sit is like using one hand in the vast ocean to catch a large fish.
As far as I've seen, from the bush and wilderness to every known city,
you've been listening to Women on the Line and hearing from Anastasia Gomez, Laura Renata Martin, Maya Gonzalez, and Silvia Frederici, recorded at the Historical Materialism Conference in New York in 2011. You also heard Alice Walker reading Sojourner Truth's 1851 speech against racial and gender injustice, and her own poem, You Confide in Me. Kate Tempest performed her poem, What We Came After. Harriet Hanson Robinson's account of the 1836 Lowell Cotton Mill strike was read by Lily Taylor.
Wings thanks Elena McMaster and Women on the Line for use of the audio in this program. Thanks also to your local radio station, Suzette Cullen, and Genevieve Vaughn, author of the book Forgiving, A Feminist Criticism of Exchange. To hear this and other Wings programs again, email wings@wings.org, and please like our Facebook page, facebook.com/wingsradio. The Women on the Line theme song is Slideshow at Free University by Le Tigre. The Wings sound logo is from Labana's album A Circle is Cast. This is the Women's International News Gathering Service.